Something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Man, oh man, is our theme music apropos for tonight. I know I say that probably 4 out of 5 nights, but the theme history repeating, oh, it comes into play with our first guest, Matt Taibbi. We'll get to that in just a second. Let me tell you what's happening in the second hour first. Interesting news breaking in the last couple of days that Attorney General Eric Holder is finally making the right noises. It looks like he might be actually growing, the spine that the Democratic leadership has been missing since they took over, in that he is considering appointing a special prosecutor to look into the allegations of torture. Yeah. So we'll take a look at that with Kevin Zeese of Voters for Peace in the next hour. And today, as you should be well aware, the Senate confirmation hearings for Judge Sonia Sotomayor to become the next Supreme Court Justice began today. And Doug Kendall, who is the founder and president of the Constitutional Accountability Center and is live blogging the hearings for Huffington Post, he'll join us in the next hour as well with a recap, and he'll do that throughout the course of the hearings each evening. We'll take a look back at what happened during the day. But back to the topic at hand and how history is repeating, I am thrilled that Matt Taibbi is back with us tonight. Matt Taibbi, you know his name. He is a brilliant writer for Rolling Stone magazine. I first got to speak with Matt back in March, when his piece called The Big Takeover appeared in Rolling Stone. And my eyes tended to roll back in my head whenever I tried to understand what was going on with AIG and the various collateralized debt obligations and credit default swaps and stuff. And I don't know how Matt Taibbi did it, but he spent a lot of time making rhyme and reason out of this very complicated situation and putting it in writing in Rolling Stone magazine in a form that even I could understand. And so that was an amazing interview, and I loved it. And then when the current issue came out, and it features the Great American Bubble Machine, and it's all about Goldman Sachs and how basically they're responsible for all the catastrophic financial ruin we've been suffering for, well, going back to the Great Depression. And I read this too, and I'm blown away. So, Matt Taibbi, thank you so much, first of all, for your work, and second of all, for staying up late to join us tonight on Air America.
No, thanks for having me on, Nicole. I was up already.
So. Okay, good. I'm glad to hear it. You know, when we spoke last time, I asked you how long you had been working on that piece, The Big Takeover. And you said it was quite a long time. It was a long process. And actually, in reading this piece, where you detail really the 5 bubbles we've experienced at the hands of Goldman Sachs, and you sort of give us a glimpse into the future of the 6th one, the Big Takeover really is only one of the 5 bubbles that we've lived through. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we wrote this piece, what we tried to do is we wanted to tell a story about what Wall Street has been doing kind of in general over the last 2 decades, and we wanted to use one investment bank, the history of one investment bank, to kind of tell that story. So we picked Goldman Sachs. They were the obvious choice, and we really focused on 3 bubbles. I know our editors talked a little bit about the bailout, and we also mentioned some things that went on in the Great Depression, but the 3 real big calamities that we've gone through in the last couple of decades were the internet/tech bubble, the housing/credit bubble, which was the thing that blew up in the last couple of years. And then there's a 3rd one that most people don't know about, which is the commodities bubble. which most people experienced last summer as this catastrophic rise in gas prices. And a lot of people don't realize that that was a purely speculative phenomenon, that that had nothing to do whatsoever with supply and demand. It was purely the result of bank speculators like Goldman and Morgan Stanley running up prices. So we tried to focus on those three stories in particular to make it kind of simpler for everybody.
So Goldman Sachs has survived through all, you know, through the last couple of years where some of their competitors, most notably probably Lehman Brothers, didn't. And what it looks like is there's no way that they will ever fail in the future because the government won't let them.
Yeah, in fact, I spoke with Simon Johnson, who's an MIT professor, who wrote a kind of a famous article in Atlantic last year comparing the United States to various third world countries he dealt with while working for the IMF. And, you know, I asked him, is it an implicit advantage for Goldman Sachs in the market that everybody knows that, you know, the government is never going to let them fail, that, you know, if they ever get in trouble, that there's going to be some kind of bailout or some kind of assistance? And he said, no, it's not an implicit advantage at all. He goes, it's an explicit advantage at this point. You know, I think after what happened with in 1 week in September last year when the government simultaneously let Lehman Brothers fail, and Lehman Brothers was Goldman's number one competitor, and rescued Goldman via the AIG bailout, it was understood on Wall Street that Goldman kind of reigned supreme and that the government was never, ever going to let them, you know, get into serious trouble.
Now, is Goldman so big because they've had so many people leave there and enter the realm of government and in all the agencies that govern the financial markets?
Well, that's certainly a major factor in the bank's success. Obviously they're good at what they do too, but you know, a lot of what they're good at is kind of slimy. But certainly the fact that they've had so many people leave the bank and go on to influential positions, and it's not just the two Treasury secretaries. Bob Rubin was Clinton's Treasury secretary, and Hank Paulson was Bush's last Treasury secretary. But even just looking at right now, I mean, the head of the New York Stock Exchange, the head of the New York Fed, the head of the Canadian National Bank, the Italian National Bank, the World Bank, is a number two guy at the Treasury, the head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. All of these people are ex-Goldman bankers. And it seems like everywhere you look, there's an ex-Goldman guy, and they have this massive network of contacts to draw upon whenever there's some kind of crisis. And that's certainly a big factor in their success.
Right, and it seems not only crisis, though, because from reading your piece, it seems like they're great at being able to get laws and regulations changed to work in their favor.
Yeah, you know, there have been a number of instances of that. Probably the most famous instance was back in 2004 when Hank Paulson, who at the time was the head of Goldman Sachs, he went to the SEC with a group of other bankers, the heads of four other investment banks on Wall Street, and basically just asked to have restrictions on lending removed. It used to be in the old days that the investment banks had to have at least $1 for every 12 they lent out. And Paulson went to the SEC and said, hey, you know, the market's booming, things are different now. Can you guys lift those restrictions? And the SEC just did it. You know, there wasn't a hearing about it. There wasn't a vote in Congress about it. They just did it. And, you know, a few years later, next thing you know, Bear Stearns is lending out $33 for every one it had. And Lehman was lending out $32. And Goldman was lending out $24. And that was a big reason that the former two banks blew up and that Goldman itself was in serious trouble last year.
Wow. That's interesting. Nat Taibbi is with us here. I'm Nicole Sandler. The article, The Great American Bubble Machine, parts of it are excerpted at rollingstone.com, but I encourage you to go out and pick up the magazine because I sat there this weekend and it's not you know, it's not like an easy day at the beach read. I got to tell you, it took me a while to get through this, and I had to go through back, you know, and reread a few paragraphs, because as I told you probably last time, is when I start talking about financial things, my eyes tend to roll back in my head and they glaze over.
You're not the only one, but go ahead.
So, but I really wanted to understand this, and the more I read and the more I understood, the scarier it became, because I'm really afraid if we think it was bad, you know, over the last year, it doesn't look like it's going to get any better, because nothing has been fixed. Nothing, in other words, nothing fixed is the wrong word. I guess it's all been fixed in their favor. Nothing has been changed to regulate these people and to regulate the markets so to protect the public.
No, I mean, nothing has changed. And you know, the likelihood is that nothing's going to change. I mean, one of the things that Goldman is so great at is that they, you know, they've been able to infiltrate government by, you know, being a primary source of campaign contributions. They were the number one private contributor to Barack Obama, and they were also a leading contributor to the Democratic congressional candidates last year. They donated almost $4.5 million to Democratic congressional candidates last year, and as a result, you know, it seems like they never ever face any kind of serious scrutiny. And even when they do get caught up in something, the worst result they ever have to deal with is paying a minuscule fine, and they usually never even have to make an admission of wrongdoing. The most recent example of that was a case in Massachusetts in which they had to pay, you know, a $50 million settlement for selling fraudulent mortgages in Massachusetts, which is like, you know, half a day's work for their fixed income desk. So, yeah, they never really have to face any serious punishment, and that's one of the big problems.
Yeah, and you mentioned, I think, the biggest problem of all was that, all right, Goldman was the biggest campaign contributor to President Obama, and to, I mean, you know, they contributed a lot to the Republicans, too, but they saw the writing on the wall and knew the Democrats were going to be elected, so they sunk even more money into the Democrats' campaigns. And until we get campaign finance reform in a real meaningful way, I don't think we're ever going to be able to change the system.
No, and, you know, the funny thing is that they've managed to kind of go so completely under the radar. I mean, I remember when I was covering Barack Obama on the campaign trail last year, I remember him saying over and over again that, you know, he was never going to have a registered lobbyist in his White House. Well, you know, what happens? 3 weeks into his presidency or a month into his presidency, he names Mark Patterson, who's a registered lobbyist for Goldman Sachs, to the number two post at the Treasury.
Wow.
And it just seems like, you know, and he put a guy in Gary Gensler, who was, you know, a Goldman Sachs banker in charge of regulating the commodities markets. And he also named Bob Rubin, the former head of Goldman Sachs, to head his economic transition team. So these guys get what they pay for. I mean, that's what they do. They're good at this stuff. And as a result, you know, we're just never going to have any serious movement in that direction until that situation's changed.
The question is, though, how bad can it get? Matt Taibbi is with us. We've got to take a break. We'll come back more about the Great American Bubble Machine, and we'll talk specifically about some of these bubbles. What happened with the internet, you know, with the tech stocks, with the housing crisis, and why did we wind up paying $4 a gallon of gas last summer and couldn't happen again? We'll be back with Matt Taibbi in a moment.
Nicole Sandler.
You're listening to Nicole Sandler.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
Nicole Sandler.
You're listening to Nicole Sandler.
And Matt Taibbi is with us as the Royal Scam plays in the background. We're talking about his piece in Rolling Stone magazine, The Great American Bubble Machine, all about how Goldman Sachs has engineered every major market manipulation since the Great Depression. And I love this line right at the beginning of your article, Matt. The world's most powerful investment bank is a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. And I guess that's the business they're in. And in a capitalistic system, that's what they're supposed to do, but not to the detriment of the economy of the country in which it operates. Doesn't that go beyond the pale?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the argument that they're always going to make is, hey, we're just smart guys, and you know, we're not a charity. We're out here to make money, and that's true. But you know, there's a spectrum of money making behavior, at one end of which is, you know, like Nigerian internet scammers, you know,
right.
And the other end is, you know, kids selling lemonade on the street. And Goldman is just way too far in one direction. I mean, they really, you know, this isn't just the story of a bunch of guys who, you know, played the market smart and made a bunch of money. This is a story about a bunch of guys who found ways, highly unscrupulous ways, to find loopholes in the regulatory environment to take advantage of people who, you know, didn't know that they were being taken advantage of to make money, and to create massive losses for certain classes of people in society. The greatest example of that being, you know, the housing mess, where, you know, Goldman was selling off billions and billions of dollars worth of subprime and non-prime mortgages to institutional investors like pension funds and insurance companies. And they were selling them as AAA-rated investments when, in fact, they were really highly risky. And that sounds like it's, you know, it sounds dull. It sounds like it's not something that's really interesting, but it's really the equivalent of selling, like, you know, rat meat as grade-A hamburger, and that's what they were doing for most
of the
year.
Right. Well, you also talk about, with the tech stocks, how they changed all the rules. It was a two-tiered investment system that the insiders knew the real numbers, but the regular schmuck out there who was, you know, making some investments or with their 401k, they were the ones who were being taken advantage of.
Yeah, Goldman was caught, and they eventually had to pay a settlement for a variety of violations during the internet years, including there are a couple of practices in particular that were, one was called spinning and the other one was called laddering. And laddering was a form of insider stock manipulation where the way it works is, if you're, you know, a company like Goldman, an underwriter is going to take an internet company public, and they go to one of their prize clients and they say, hey, we're going to sell you a million shares of this company at 16, but you have to promise to come back at 24. And buy another million shares.
All right, hold that thought because I got a break. I'm sorry, but we'll pick this up on the other side and get to laddering and what that exactly is with Matt Taibbi on Air America. We'll be right back.
Listening to Nicole Sandler on Air America Radio.
And we are back with Matt Taibbi, whose brilliant piece in Rolling Stone this month is called The Great American Bubble Machine, and it's all about Goldman Sachs and how they're just literally screwing us. They really are. And all right, so before we were so rudely interrupted by the clock, you were talking about the process or the technique called laddering.
Yeah, laddering is basically just you sell shares in an IPO in a new company to a prize client at a low price in exchange for a promise that they come back in at a higher price and buy more. So, you know, basically all that really is a form of insider manipulation where, you know, the underwriter, which is Goldman Sachs in this case, and one of its clients knows that the price is going to rise to at least a certain amount. And then it's probably going to taper off after there, or it might taper off after that point. So, you know, this is a situation where the insiders knew that it was going to go up until a certain point, and the people on the outside didn't know that early surge in the price was artificial. And that went on all throughout the internet years. And there were a variety of other schemes that were involved to pump up the price of internet stocks. But really, the main characteristic of the internet years is that the insiders knew that the price was going to go up early, and they cashed out before everybody else did. And that's how everybody lost money.
Why is Goldman Sachs allowed to get away with this stuff, and Bernie Madoff is in jail for 150 years?
Well, I mean, that's just kind of the way of things. I mean, I think everybody on Wall Street understood that, you know, when the crash happened last year, that they were going to find a way to perp walk a couple of people, and that's kind of what always happens with these financial scandals. I mean, you remember when, you know, back in the early part of the Bush administration, they got the guys from Adelphia and the Enron guys, and the Tyco guy, and Dennis Kozlowski, and you know, everybody else kind of got off scot-free, and there weren't, you know, sorry, there was Sarbanes-Oxley, but there weren't any real stiff reforms after that. You know, the main problem with what happened in the last couple of years was that there were so many instances in the last couple of decades where, you know, the state had to do something and had to impose serious punishments. And there never, not only were there never any punishments, exactly the opposite was true, that we always rewarded Wall Street with gigantic bailouts whenever they screwed up. I mean, there was the Mexican currency mess, the emerging markets mess, the long-term capital management's mess. We always gave these guys billions when they screwed up, and that's what happened again this time.
Yes, it did. And again, AIG got, what, $85 billion of our dollars, and they turned around and gave it $13 billion right to Goldman Sachs.
That's right. Yeah, the initial was $80 billion at first, and then not only did we do that, but we, you know, the Hank Paulson then installed another former Goldman banker named Ed Liddy to run AIG, which, you know, subsequently, you know, got itself paid off on 100 cents on the dollar for that, you know, for every dollar that AIG owed it, which was, you know, an enormous taxpayer bounty to Goldman Sachs that most people aren't aware of.
Right. All right. Now, last summer, when gas went up to over $4 a gallon, you point out that the short-term supply was rising, demand was falling. The way, you know, Economics 101 says prices at the pump should have been going down, but that's not what happened. And commodities trading and speculation was the cause of that?
Yeah. At the height of the craziness last summer, I remember the price of crude oil went up to $147 a barrel last summer, which is crazy. It started this year at $30 a barrel, and so that tells you how high that was. Long ago, during the Depression, there was a law, the Commodity Futures Exchange Act, which foresaw that if there were too many speculators on the market, that speculative demand would begin to outweigh real supply and demand. And so they placed limits on the amount of speculators that could exist on the market. But what happened was in the 90s, Goldman Sachs quietly got an exemption to those rules. And as a result of that, after that, a series of other companies got exemptions. And before you knew it, last summer, there were just way too many speculators in the market, and they overwhelmed the real consumers and suppliers on the market. And, you know, at the height of the craze last summer, every barrel of oil that was consumed in the United States was traded 27 times before it was consumed. So all that demand was just artificial. It was just people buying oil futures. It wasn't people really consuming gas.
So when George Bush said that there was nothing he could do about the high gas prices, that was a bunch of bull.
Yeah, and everybody got it wrong. I mean, you know, John McCain said we immediately had to start drilling offshore
right.
in the Gulf of Mexico, and Barack Obama said we had to start driving hybrid cars, and it was all a lie, and it was admitted as such just this week, as a matter of fact, when the CFTC, which regulates commodities, including oil, announced that it was going to enact a series of reforms designed to combat exactly the kind of speculation that happened last summer. And in doing so, they basically admitted that what happened last summer was a purely speculative bubble, which hadn't been admitted before. But now it's like common knowledge. Everybody knows it.
Unbelievable. And now what you're saying in your Rolling Stone piece is that we're poised for this to happen again with the cap and trade regulation, which already passed the House and is going to pass the Senate. And you're
right.
saying that Goldman Sachs is already gearing up to start trading in carbon credits.
Right, because Goldman is a part owner of the Chicago Climate Exchange, which is which is where carbon credits are going to be traded if this bill is passed. They're also heavily invested in companies that that deal in carbon credits. They spent about $3.5 million last year lobbying for this issue, and they've been lobbying for it for years. In fact, it was a pet project of Hank Paulson back when he was still running Goldman Sachs. And this carbon market is going to be just another commodities market, just like oil or, you know, gas or you know, natural gas or corn or wheat. All that stuff went soaring last summer. And what's different about it is that the way they've structured this legislation, the amount of carbon credits is going to be mandated to go down every year, which means that the carbon credits are going to automatically rise in price every year, which is going to be an enormous boon for people who are speculating in these commodities. So it's going to be a massive market. People I talk to say it's going to dwarf the oil commodities market, and the banks are already lining up to make a lot of money on this.
So we already know that energy is going to get more expensive, even if, you know, Goldman Sachs wasn't involved. But by them getting in the game on such what looks to be a massive scale, they're going to drive up the prices even more.
Right, right. And, you know, obviously it's going to have a positive effect on the environment, or it should, you know, this cap and trade thing, because it's going to, you know, force people to innovate, and it's going to make, you know, pollution expensive, which is, these are all good things. But the thing is, if they had just, you know, done a straight tax that the government set and the government collected, you wouldn't have these hidden costs in there of these other companies, you know, these private companies that are trading in these credits and making money and making money on the transactions and all of that. And all of those unseen costs, you know, are going to appear as profits for these investment banks, and we're just not going to know about it. I mean, our energy prices are going to go up, but we're not going to be aware, just like we weren't aware last summer when we were buying gas that we were giving money to Goldman Sachs. We're just not going to be aware that we're going to be putting money in the pockets of these companies.
Unbelievable. See, this is what Matt Taibbi is with me here on Air America, and this is what we were talking about during the break. I had mentioned that between, you know, the financial institutions giving so much money to politicians and basically owning Congress and possibly the executive too, and the healthcare debacle that we're living in, I'm looking for other places, you know, options to live. And this reminds me of what we're going through with the healthcare crisis, which is the fact that there's a whole industry feeding off of the backs of our healthcare, that the reason our healthcare is so expensive is because there's a whole industry that has to make a profit, and making a mightily handsome profit, on the cost, you know, that they're making this money on our healthcare, where it should be a not-for-profit entity. I think energy should be the same way. I understand business needs to survive, but for people to get obscenely wealthy on our energy and on our healthcare, I think there's something inherently wrong in that system.
Yeah, and you know, that's what's so remarkable about Goldman Sachs. That's where their skill level comes in, their political skill level, because what they specialize in is kind of getting on the right side of public policy to make themselves money. And you know, that's, you know, it's not really capitalism. They kind of exist in a gray area between the state and private enterprise, where you know, we just don't have any way of avoiding paying that profit cost to this private company that is, you know, is riding on the backs of government, you know, regulatory policy. You know, it's not like we can avoid giving these people money by just not playing in the market. They have a piece of everything, and we're going to pay that whether we like it or not. And it's a situation that's, what's most depressing about it is that we don't really have any way to redress the problem, because they have virtual control over both houses of Congress. So it's hugely depressing.
Unbelievable. A listener sent me a link to a story from the Raw Story about the New York Stock Exchange ending transparency to protect Goldman Sachs. They announced last week that the New York Stock Exchange announced that it would end its practice of requiring companies to report all their program trading. And so, again, so people have less indication of what they're doing?
This is an amazing story. There's actually a blogger who goes by the nom de plume Tyler Durden, and he writes for a blog called Zero Hedge, and they have been pushing this this theory for months now that Goldman Sachs is using some kind of high-powered computer program to manipulate the computerized trading volume on the New York Stock Exchange. And they've been pushing this theory by analyzing the data that the New York Stock Exchange released week about computerized trading, which is called program trading. And basically, in order to shut up this one blogger who became a serious problem for them, Goldman apparently prevailed upon the New York Stock Exchange to stop releasing that data. And they did it, you know, which kind of shows you both the amazing attention to the criticism they get and the incredible influence that this one bank has over almost everybody.
Goldman
asks,
kind of
an amazing story.
Goldman asks, and they acquiesce. What was the old investment house when? Was it Lehman? Lehman speaks and everyone listens.
E.F. Hutton.
Right?
E.F. Hutton. When they speak, people listen. The other E.F. Hutton, right?
Yeah, right. So now Goldman asks, and they give. I guess this is unbelievable.
And there's an interesting footnote to the story. If you got another one other minute, is that last week there was a guy who worked for Goldman named Sergei Alenikov, who worked in that computerized trading department, who stole Goldman's computer program and attempted to sell it to another company, and he was arrested by the FBI. And in the indictment, I'm sorry, in the arraignment for this guy, the prosecutor said that Goldman said that in the wrong hands, this program could be used to unfairly manipulate the market, which is basically just an admission that they had some kind of a program that they were using to, you know, manipulate the markets.
Right. In the wrong hands. Gee, that's the pot calling the kettle black, you know, to use an old cliche. Matt Taibbi, it is always a pleasure talking to you. I love reading your work. And you said, as we were having that discussion during the break, your next one is going to be on the healthcare industry, huh?
Exactly. Yeah, one depressing story to another.
I hope you're not a big drinker.
No, I'm not. I'm beyond that, actually. So, but I'm not going to get into that on the air. So.
Okay. So are you into it already? You have already begun work on it?
I'm going to D.C. tomorrow afternoon, actually, to continue following. But, you know, I'm sure as you're aware, there's a lot of pessimism on the Hill from people who are hoping to get a public option on the table, and that's kind of the angle that I've been following, is whether or not there's going to be a public option in the final bill. And you know, a lot of people think that there isn't going to be in the final analysis. So that's what I'm working on.
And as you said during the break, with this mandate that this administration and the Democrats were elected in this last election year, if they don't get it done, then it just shows that we have no control over our government.
That's kind of the angle that we're taking, that this is kind of a litmus test for whether or not this government is going to be real about anything at all, because this is the number one issue that people care about. They have 60 votes. They're completely bulletproof in terms of whether or not if they wanted to push this thing through, they could. So if they don't, that tells you where we all stand, and that's kind of a scary thought.
That's so depressing. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Well, Matt Taibbi, thank you for your work. As I said at the beginning, I salute you, and I love talking to you, and I look forward to reading your next piece on healthcare.
Thanks a lot, Nicole.
Thank you so much. All right, you too. Good night. Wow. Matt Taibbi, again, Rolling Stone magazine, the piece is called The Great American Bubble Machine. It is brilliant reporting. He is, I got to say, my favorite investigative journalist out there. Everything he writes, I read voraciously, and what a treat it is to talk to him. All right, we'll take a break, come back, maybe listen to a couple of clips from today's Sonia Sotomayor hearings, the first day, and in the next hour, we'll get a little further in-depth into it. Nicole Sandler, we'll be right back.
Nicole Sandler.
You're listening to Nicole Sandler on Air America Radio.